One thing for certain we can tell you about Bitcoin or any cyber currency, nobody ever counts it out in bills like with dollars. One other thing for certain, cyber currencies depend upon the blockchain technology to work. What is blockchain, you ask, perhaps nervously? At least one listener contacted us after our last blockchain discussion to say he was still confused. We try again today with two Stevens. Stephen Williams wrote the book Blockchain, The Next Everything. He's a journalist and author and the head of a fashion startup which uses blockchain technology to manage distributed manufacturing. Stephen Williams, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Stephen McKeon's with us as well. He's an associate professor of finance and the academic director at the Cameron Center for Finance and Securities Analysis at the University of Oregon. He visited last August for a blockchain chat. Stephen McKeon, welcome back.
Thank you.
I would be surprised if you two had not met. Stephen Williams, have you?
No, I don't believe we have.
Okay, all right.
We have met. We've probably been at the same conference at some point.
Okay, that makes a certain amount of sense. Stephen Williams, tell us about your fashion company, William Williams, and how you use blockchain there.
So what it is I'm developing a distributed system. It's evolved into a distributed system that will encourage manufacturers to reuse materials in order to reduce carbon output. And the way that is done is through incentives using cryptocurrency and tokens on blockchain.
Okay, so it's not just a matter of using the blockchain for its ledger capabilities, but having the cryptocurrency involved in the mix as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I see blockchain and cryptocurrency as being sort of rocket fuel for each other in terms of being able to incentivize people to get things done.
Okay, so the one of the attractions then to using blockchain is that the cryptocurrency that comes with it helps people see that there's some ways to gain some wealth.
Well, to gain wealth and also, to reward people for certain behaviors. I'm looking at cryptocurrencies as separate from being just financial instruments or investments, more as a way of incentivizing people.
Okay, and so was William Williams designed then around the use of blockchain?
William Williams began as an effort to reuse materials. That was my initial effort, a sustainable fashion company. And the more I learned about distributed systems, I experimented with distributed manufacturing, and I've ended up, it's an evolving project, and I've ended up with this idea that I'm working on right now.
So are there clothing items under that brand name out on the racks now? I mean, can you buy William Williams merchandise?
No, and you won't be able to. That's how it started out, and we had samples on a line. There's a website. But now I'm going purely into a system that will reward people and manufacturers for reusing products. And we're starting with fashion, but I think that the system will work with other industries.
All right. So you observe in the book that people talk a lot about blockchain with little real understanding. I want to ask Stephen McKeon if that's your experience as well, that people do talk a lot about it without necessarily knowing quite what they're saying.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of confusion about the differences, like what is blockchain, what is cryptocurrency. I teach this topic at the University of Oregon, and I always start from the basis of no prior knowledge. And so it's, you know, I think a little information goes a long way in terms of helping people understand what this is and trying to map it to some of the things they understand that have nothing to do with blockchain to kind of demonstrate where the innovation is and why these things are important and how they're different from a regular database.
So, Steve McKeon, people do love and it appears need stories. Have you found one particularly effective one for explaining distributed ledger and blockchain?
Yeah, I mean, we have a few analogies we draw. People are often confused about mining. You hear about Bitcoin miners, and people get an image in their head of, you know, a gold miner with a pickaxe or something like that. And the better analogy we found that helps people understand it is an accountant, right? So you could kind of think of a blockchain as a ledger, and we all know what ledgers are. We use them in everyday life for accounting and recording transactions of all types. And the idea with blockchain is that we've now got a group that's maintaining the ledger. And that group are the Bitcoin miners. They're the ones posting new blocks. And so the analogy we often use when we describe that is something closer to accountants, right? So if you think of these miners as basically accountants and they're collecting up the transactions and then posting them to the ledger, they're kind of doing the same work you would expect an accountant to do, but they're getting rewarded to do it with the creation of new Bitcoin or whatever chain they're working on. Sometimes that analogy, the analogy of accountants just posting transactions to a ledger, is a little easier to grasp as a mental model.
So there has to be mining to create new blocks for the blockchain, or is that just an adjunct?
So there has to be mining to, and this is where it can get a little bit technical. So you can create something called a token on top of another blockchain, and that does not have to have mining. But somewhere there's got to be mining if it's a so-called proof-of-work system, and that's one of the things that keeps it secure, and it's one of the things that keeps everybody having a copy of the same ledger and making the transactions immutable or very, very difficult to change. There are other systems that don't use mining, but this is probably not the right venue to dive down that rabbit hole.
Okay, let's give everybody a chance to take a breath as we step back for just a moment about getting into a further discussion of blockchain. Steve McKeon is at the University of Oregon. Stephen Williams is the author of Blockchain, The Next Everything. We'll come back and continue the discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange. As we head to the break, I'll remind you that it is spring fun to drive time here on JPR. The next to last day, we're not quite to $75,000, which would represent the halfway point to our goal of $150,000. So activity really needs to step up in the final hours for us to be able to make that goal. The additional goal, 325 new members. Does that sound like you? Give us a call at 888-552-6191 or pledge online at ijpr.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're exploring the concept of blockchain again, and not necessarily as relates to cybercurrency, but it always ends up in the discussion anyway. Stephen Williams is the author of a book called Blockchain, The Next Everything, which helps describe what goes on blockchain and what it makes possible. Steve McKeon is an associate professor of finance and the academic director at the Cameron Center for Finance and Securities Analysis at the University of Oregon, an expert in cybersecurity. You can join us on the cybersecurities, I should say, with an S. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Stephen Williams, you give a good list in the book. What kinds of things do ledgers make possible? And does the concept of ledger really change that much from the kind you write in by hand when they become distributed ledgers through blockchain?
I think the basic concept stays very much the same. The illustration I like to think of is the old green ledger book that my grandparents used on their farm to record tractor sales and pennies that they saved and pennies that they spent. But ledgers do form the basis of, you know, everything in our society. We wouldn't be able to have elections without ledgers. We wouldn't be able to keep our track of our money at the bank without ledgers. They just cover everything.
You remind
they
us.
They seem pretty unexciting, but they really are pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's certainly a lot of information to be found in any ledger. You remind us, though, that blockchain and the distributed ledger is not the same thing as Bitcoin. Does the digital currency confuse people about blockchain, do you find, Steve Williams?
Oh, yes, for sure. And I think it taints the concept of blockchain because of the speculation and greed that people associate with Bitcoin, over the last few years has made people think that blockchain is just a way of scamming people or, you know, getting something for nothing. And I don't really think that's true for cryptocurrency either, but I do understand the misperception. Blockchain the blockchain we are talking about was invented in 2008 based on older technologies. And it was made to support the Bitcoin platform, to keep track of where the coins went, who owned them, who spent them, who had them. So because, as you said, you can't carry them around in your pocket. So blockchain is a foundational technology. It underlies Bitcoin, but it has many other uses and is being used by corporations, universities, nonprofits, artists, all kinds of things around the world right now.
So then is the use of blockchain that doesn't involve cryptocurrency, was that just sort of a side benefit? Did the people who created blockchain not think that these are the kinds of uses it might have?
Well, I think that people who've been creating distributed ledger technologies, of which blockchain is one, have had other uses in mind, but certainly the blockchain we're talking about now was definitely invented for cryptocurrencies and for Bitcoin, and then people started realizing how important and radical the technology was and began to apply it to other industries.
Steve McKeon, I'll ask you to answer this email, not just because it comes from John and Eugene, but it's kind of the stuff you were talking about already. John wonders why the cryptocurrencies are created, in quotes, by having computers spin their wheels or chips endlessly. Where is the value, and can you compare it to our green money and its, in quotes, value? That from John and Eugene.
Sure. So, that's a really big question. I guess I'll tackle the first question first, which is this idea of proof of work, which means that you have a lot of computers all trying to solve a puzzle to be, you know, quote unquote, the accountant for the block. And the reason they want to contribute that work to the network is because they're going to get paid for doing so. And that is the model that Satoshi Nakamoto came up with when the Bitcoin white paper was created over 10 years ago at this point. And a lot of people have recognized that there is a lot of energy usage in that model. It is one of the things that makes the chain very secure, which is where part of the value comes from. There are, as I mentioned, there are other models that use a lot less energy. Proof of stake would be something your listeners can Google if they want to learn more about it. And so I would say that everyone's very aware that there's a lot of energy being used by the proof of work systems, and there are a lot of alternatives that are being developed. Now where the value comes from, the analogy I usually like to draw there is of gold, right? So gold, the price of gold doesn't have a lot to do with the uses of gold. It can be used in electronics, can be used as jewelry. But the price of gold is mostly set by a market with buyers and sellers who decide as a society what gold's going to be worth. And you can think of Bitcoin in the same way. There are markets where the asset is traded, and some people, if there's more demand than there is supply, then the price is going to go up. And if everyone decided tomorrow that they didn't want to hold Bitcoin anymore, then the price would go down. And it's actually the same statement would be true about gold. If everyone tomorrow decided that they didn't want to hold gold anymore and everybody sold off their gold assets, you would see the price plummet, right? Gold has value because we as a society have decided it has value. And you could think about Bitcoin in much the same way.
So it's basically agreeing that something has value together. And then if you all decide, you know what, it doesn't have value, poof, away it goes.
Right. It's a market outcome, much the way many assets in society are.
Steve McKeon is at the University of Oregon, Associate Professor of Finance and the Academic Director at the Cameron Center for Finance and Securities Analysis at the U of O. Stephen Williams is the author of Blockchain, The Next Everything. We're talking about blockchain, obviously, here on the Jefferson Exchange. Here's a call from Boris in Eugene. Welcome to the exchange.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about the energy consumption. As we all try to reduce our energy use, or is that all going to be overwhelmed by the demands of blockchain?
Let's talk about the mining. Stephen Williams, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, and I agree with what the other Stephen just said. But I question some of the figures that we see about how much electricity the Bitcoin blockchain uses. I do believe it's energy intensive, but someone asked me the other day that if Bitcoin used as much energy as the entire rest of the world uses. And, there are a lot of, stories going around that don't make much sense in that regard. Another thing I'd like to just propose is that if Bitcoin were to become a widely used currency in our society and in the global society, It would reduce the energy consumption of banks, ATMs. Think of all the energy that is used to support our current financial system. And I think that that's often overlooked when we talk about the waste of blockchain. That said, I'm totally against wasting energy, and I personally don't own Bitcoin for that very reason.
Interesting. So Stephen McKeon, since we already have no gold standard, as you were just talking about, and we have debit cards and electronic ways to transfer our money, our currency is more or less virtual now anyway. So what does somebody gain by having their wealth in Bitcoin versus dollars?
Yeah, so we do have a lot of digital forms of money. However, the thing I would point out is that all that value moves through intermediaries. And the reason that that's important is because intermediaries can create frictions in certain areas. So, for example, if I want to send money to, so I'm actually currently at Cambridge here in the UK. If I want to send money back to the US, there's a lot of frictions involved. There's a lot of costs if I do that through the banking system, right? If I was to send Bitcoin, it takes a few minutes and maybe a few cents, right? And so there are going to, I think the place where we can see a lot of friction reduced is around cross-border payments. And in fact, the aspect of blockchain that I study, which are tokenized securities or taking regular financial securities like equity and debt and real estate, so like shares of stock or bonds, and putting them on chain, a lot of those frictions can be resolved by using this form of record keeping. And so you see a lot of cost compression in a lot of the normal costs that are involved with moving value.
We are talking about blockchain and, by extension, cyber currencies here on the Jefferson Exchange with two guests, both of them named Stephen. Stephen Williams is the author of the book Blockchain, The Next Everything. He's a journalist, author, and head of a fashion startup which uses blockchain technology to help reuse materials. Steve McKeon, associate professor of finance, academic director at the Cameron Center for Finance and Securities Analysis at the University of Oregon. He visited last August here on the Exchange. You can join us with your questions, your comments, your probing thoughts about blockchain and Bitcoin and all the other stuff that comes along with it. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Just to kind of come back to a reset point, Stephen Williams, there's a great quote in your book about blockchain being difficult to understand for otherwise intelligent people. So that brings us to your story. How long did it take you?
Well, I first came across the word about 3.5 or 4 years ago, when I was studying my MBA in sustainability, and I was intrigued by it and started reading about it and totally became obsessed with it, as so many people do. And I spent several years teaching myself. I've been a writer all my life, written many books and articles, and I realized that there were not very many books written for a lay audience, for the general public, to help them understand this quite complex technology. So I decided to write that book. But I would say it took 2.5 years of study and visiting conferences and talking to people before I felt comfortable really diving into the subject.
So back to the story question that I asked Steve McKeon earlier, is there a particular story or analogy you can give that seems to make this work better for some people?
Well, I'm quite intrigued by the distributed nature of blockchain, meaning that it's, as Steve already said, that it's contained on all the computers or devices that participate in the blockchain, the miners, and also other nodes on the chain. And I'd like to illustrate that by having people consider that for most of their lives and in most institutions that we're involved in, we're dealing with a hierarchical top-down system, like just a line from the president to you, or from your father to you, or in that way. But with distributed systems, I think if you think of a starry night and you look at all the stars in the sky, and you imagine the one closest to you is connected to the one next to it, and that is connected to another one, and throughout the sky, all the stars are connected, and the furthest one is actually connected to you. I think that describes a distributed system quite well. for as a metaphor.
So not central hubs. It's not like everything revolves around one central point. It's all sorts of connections and interconnections between in this case stars in the sky.
Yes.
You write in the book, it takes an almost spiritual leap to conceptualize how blockchain will affect many things. What kinds of things do you see blockchain getting into further that would change the way folks are doing business now?
Well, I think that some of the more far-reaching potential changes revolve around this distributed nature. And for instance, I was speaking with Jess Holgrove, who started a company called Codex Protocol in England that tracks provenance of artwork. It can record when an artwork was made, how it was made, and who has owned it along the way. So she set up this business, very complex business, raised a lot of money to start it, and it's on a distributed blockchain, and her intention is to, as she puts it, devolve her ownership until she owns none of it, and the entire company is owned and run by the people who participate on the blockchain. So I find that a very hard concept to imagine that a capitalist such as her would want to have her company become a completely communal experience. But I think that is really the wave of the future. I think distributed systems are going to be seen as more efficient, more creative, and with much more potential than the top-down systems we have now, which contain a lot of friction and also repress a lot of creative input from people who aren't, say, leaders within the organization.
Steve McKeon, this sounds like a democratization process in much the way that people don't have to rely upon mass media from big cities anymore. They can just get information out themselves through the Internet. Is this a democratization of finances in the world?
Absolutely. And it's interesting because one of the sort of sayings that we often repeat is that what the Internet did to media, blockchains will do to finance, which is to say that there are entirely new rails that are being created to move value, much in the same way that the Internet created new rails for content and for messages. And when you can democratize finance in the same way that content's been democratized, you end up with a lot of interesting angles to kind of pursue as you think about that. I mean, certainly the idea that more and more people from around the world could own assets that were created in the U.S. So it's actually quite difficult to buy, say, shares of Microsoft in some countries. And that said, that you know, we know that over long periods of time, returns in things like the stock market or the bond market have higher returns than keeping your money in the form of cash. And so we think that, you know, creating more wealth generation for a larger segment of people around the world is one of the interesting outcomes we're going to see from the proliferation of blockchain.
So if we're keeping with the analogy to media, where old media organizations have really suffered in their ability to pull in revenue, does this mean we're going to see a big ding on banks and investment centers and even stock exchanges?
We think it's going to have an impact on all the players in finance. And so that's not necessarily just limited to stock exchanges and intermediaries, but you know, could extend to insurance and payment processors, and you know, just think about anywhere value moves. That is potentially an area that's going to be impacted by blockchains. Now, that's not to say that all the companies will be disrupted. Many of them will adopt the technology as it evolves and work with companies that are, you know, facilitating these new tools for some of the incumbents. But certainly the old way of moving value is going to be going away over the next 5 to 10 years.
Let's take another phone call before we get to a break. Karen in Mount Shasta, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Steve McKeon and Stephen Williams.
Yeah, hello. The hardest thing for me to understand is, where does the coin come from? I mean, you use a gold analogy. Well, gold was made when the earth was made, and there's a finite amount of it, and we dig it up and use it. But who makes Bitcoin, and where, I mean, how is it regulated? How much is made, or who makes it?
Yeah, good questions, Karen. Thanks for that. Steve McKeon?
Yeah, so just like gold, no one regulates how much gold there is. There is a finite amount, as you described. And it's interesting, there actually is a finite amount of Bitcoin as well. So the maximum number of Bitcoins there will ever be is 21 million. There's about, I believe, between 17 and 18 million that exist today. The way new Bitcoins are created is through this process where computers or nodes or miners do the accounting for the network, and in exchange for doing the accounting and posting transactions to the ledger, a little bit of new Bitcoin is created. But what happens is that over time, that reward in Bitcoin gets cut in half, and it gets cut in half and in half and in half, and eventually the reward will go away, and those miners will just be paid with transaction fees. And so actually, there is a lot of analogies to gold in that sense in terms of scarcity, and I think the caller has a great point that scarcity is a really important component. And Bitcoin does have that in the sense that 21 million is the maximum that will ever exist.
Okay, a ceiling certainly for Bitcoin at some point. Steve McKeon and Stephen Williams are guests on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about blockchain. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are working once again to understand blockchain and the cybercurrencies that ride on the blockchain technology in a couple of different ways, or at least with different people, both of them named Stephen. Stephen Williams is the author of Blockchain, The Next Everything, a recent book. Steve McKeon is an associate professor of finance and the academic director at the Cameron Center for Finance and Securities Analysis at the University of Oregon. He's on the line from the UK. You can join the conversation as we try to understand blockchain once again. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Stephen Williams, in the book, you write that technology has no intrinsic ability to improve our society. Is it at least neutral, do you think?
Well, this technology, I think, is, I would say it is neutral. It's a neutral platform, and it's a soulless platform. It has no morality, and we can choose to build on it in ways that we wish.
You entertain the thought that this could be the new segue, that the hype is a bit over the top, and that the sales reality or the use reality doesn't end up quite with where we thought things might be originally.
Well, I think that's always a danger with new technologies, and this one in particular, for kind of mysterious reasons to me, has produced a massive amount of hype. And there are plenty of people you could get on your show who would tell you that blockchain is a fraud and that cryptocurrencies are nothing more than a Ponzi scheme. I don't believe that, but I do caution about embracing the technology and all of its potential uses too quickly and too readily.
Is the main stumbling block to understanding blockchain the distributed part of it? Is this sort of like doing something in New York and having it happen in London at the same time?
No, I don't. I think that might be one of the big conceptual leaps that people have to make, understanding distributed systems. But I do believe the hardest thing for people to understand about blockchain technology is how the consensus is reached with mining or other protocol or other forms. And how the blockchain is carried on all the computers, yeah. People just seem to have a very... I think what happens is that when people start explaining blockchain to other people, they start talking about very technical details, and the people who aren't technologists get lost, and instead of seeing the trees, they just see the forest.
Is this part of the effort in blockchain, the next everything, to explain the forest and the trees?
Well, my whole point was to give an accessible book built on anecdotes and storytelling that would allow people to finish it kind of having an experience of what blockchain might be in their lives or in their businesses going forward.
So, Steve McKeon, there was an article 2 weeks ago in Crypto Slate that includes this sentence about you. And it gets a little dense. McKeon anticipates that a Bitcoin ETF will give institutional investors greater access to the asset, increasing the demand and price of BTC, which I'm sure makes a lot of people go, huh?
So I guess the journalist in that particular case was asking me about what impact would an ETF, an exchange traded fund. So we have a lot of these today, not on Bitcoin, but on lots of other assets, right? Like you could buy a gold ETF. You could buy an ETF with just, airline stocks probably, or bank stocks, or, you know, basically different sectors of the economy. So we've got ETFs for kind of everything. Like you could buy an ETF that just has companies from Norway or Europe or anything like this. So it's a way for retail investors to get exposure to a particular type of asset or a group of assets, I should say. So one of the things that's been a challenge is that Bitcoin has not been easy to purchase historically, right? So certainly if you go back, you know, several years, you really need to have a high degree of technical savvy. And then more recently, we have had entrants into the market like Coinbase and Bitstamp and so on that have made it easier. But for a lot of investors, they wouldn't mind having some exposure to these assets with the idea that it further diversifies the portfolio. But they really just don't want to go through the headache of setting up a separate account. And so the idea is that there is some demand that's out there that would purchase some Bitcoin if they could buy it through their Schwab account or E-Trade or Merrill Lynch. But they're really not going to bother going out and setting up a separate crypto trading account. And so the idea is that if there's if an ETF is created that is allowed to hold Bitcoin, that presumably there's going to be demand for that product. And if there's demand, as I mentioned, it's, you know, the price of Bitcoin is a market outcome. So it would push the price up. Now, to date, the SEC has not approved any of the Bitcoin ETF proposals that have come through for a variety of reasons. But we think that we're actually pretty close to having solved most of those problems around manipulation and surveillance of the markets. And so I suspect one probably will be approved before too much longer.
Okay, I have further questions about regulation right now. I want to take a call from Jeff in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, good morning. I have a question about, I guess, sticking with the investment theme, or whether you're traveling overseas, how would a cryptocurrency handle the foreign exchange rate? Does foreign exchange do those rates disappear because you now have a global currency? Or if you could just talk to that.
Okay, thanks for that, Jeff.
Yeah, so basically you can trade Bitcoin against many, many, many different currencies. And so if somebody was to send me one Bitcoin, I receive one Bitcoin, right? So there's not been any currency translation. However, if I want to then withdraw that from the exchange, say into, I'm here in the UK, so maybe into pounds, I would sell the Bitcoin through my broker that I'm using. Maybe I'm using Bitstamp, which is a Bitcoin exchange. And there would be a price in pounds that's moving every second, right? Just like you see stock prices move. The only difference is it's actually moving 24/7. So these markets never really close. So at any time, there's going to be a price of Bitcoin in dollars, and there's going to be a price of Bitcoin in pounds. And a whole nother category of cryptocurrencies are called stable coins, where they actually don't move against those currencies. They're kind of pegged to the pound or pegged to the dollar so that you don't have to bear that kind of currency risk.
Okay, so a couple more questions to come about the specifics, but I want to ask Stephen Williams a more general question, because as you indicate in the book, there are lots of good feelings, or at least high hopes, for blockchain, as there were for the World Wide Web, which can give you access to much of the world's knowledge, and of course a lot of lies and advertising as well. Are there concerns that you have seen or felt yourself about blockchain being perverted or twisted or misused?
Certainly, with blockchain, there you can't escape the problem of garbage in, garbage out. And blockchain is a ledger, and if you record false information, that information will remain false on the blockchain. As I said, it has no morality or any way to make things truthful. So people could put false information onto a blockchain. I think one interesting thing that might mitigate that is that once they put false information on a blockchain, it will remain on that blockchain, you know, in perpetuity, and so it could be uncovered or revealed further down the line. It would always be apparent that that person had, or that entity had put a lie, registered a lie onto a blockchain. And one thing I want to mention just as an aside is that, I don't know if the audience knows, but there can be many, many blockchains. There's not just the Bitcoin blockchain. There are, you know, we can create as many as we want.
All right. And again, it's a distributed ledger, not hackable because it's on so many places. And as you mentioned, a lie remains a lie, but the truth remains the truth as well, because blockchain, nobody can change the transaction once it's recorded. Is that right?
Yes, pretty much so. Yeah, it's not. There's some debate about the complete security of it, but it's designed definitely that way.
Steve McKeon, as we talk about the trading of bitcoins and trying to get things like exchange-traded funds going on, it raises the question about whether it's possible that blockchain, currencies aside, would end up the playground of the rich and powerful, or is this really a case where it could be for everybody?
We very much believe it is going to be for everybody, and in fact, my guess is that in 10 years, the majority of your audience is interacting with blockchain in some way. Now, I think the way this is going to evolve is that they're not going to have to know they're interacting with blockchain, right? But I think in 10 years from now or so, it's going to be as uncommon to meet someone who doesn't have a digital wallet as it is uncommon to meet someone who doesn't have an email address today, right? So 20 years ago, many of your listeners probably didn't have email addresses. Today, my guess is that virtually all of them have an email address. And it's odd to meet someone who doesn't have an email address today, because you think, how am I going to send electronic messages to this person? Well, someday it'll be the same thing, but with value, right? So if you don't have a digital wallet, it'll be akin to sort of not having a bank account or not having a way to receive value. Now, we don't know exactly what those are going to look like. They could be integrated in with your email address. They could be integrated into your internet browser. It could be integrated into your phone is a pretty high likelihood. But we think that, you know, your listeners and the general public, I guess, more generally, will be interacting with blockchain in various ways. But they might be in ways that they don't require any technical expertise. Like, you don't need to be able to explain SMTP in order to use email. It's going to be the same thing with blockchain.
Good analogy. I was hoping you'd put one in there about that. Yes, so you don't have to understand the technology to be able to use it. But a lot more chances to explore blockchain in the future. We're talking to Steve McKeon from the University of Oregon, Associate Professor of Finance and Academic Director at the Cameron Center for Finance and Securities Analysis, and Stephen Williams, the author of Blockchain, The Next Everything. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.